Honour and a pleasure to welcome Minister Motsoaledi to the Foundation this afternoon. We're also very honoured to welcome our distinguished lead discussants, Ambassador Eric Goosby and our CSIS colleague, Jennifer Cook, and grateful as always to CSIS for graciously co-hosting the event with us today. Minister, I must tell you, standing here to welcome you makes me feel that we have come, in a sense, full circle. Because when Kaiser began working in South Africa now about 23 years ago, one of the very first, in fact the second program we helped establish together with Dr. Motsoaledi was in his hometown of Jane Furze, Sekhukhune land. And I'm very proud to say the program is still going strong today. We have enjoyed a very long and sound relationship with Dr. Motsoaledi since in his role as community physician and activist, as a leader of the progressive health movement that helped shape the post-apartheid health system, and as a political leader, initially in the provincial government and more recently in his role as National Health Minister. Since his appointment as Health Minister in May 2009, Dr. Motsoaledi has brought a veritable hurricane of new vigour to the public health sector in South Africa, most notably resuscitating the primary healthcare fundamentals of the post-apartheid health system, putting in place a comprehensive national HIV/AIDS management strategy, and directing and planning implementation of a national health insurance scheme. As you can see from this audience, there is a lot of interest in South Africa's progress, Minister, and I am very pleased now to invite you to speak.
Thank you, Program Director, Dr. Sinclair. Ambassador Goosby and Jennifer Cook, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I am going to try in as short a space as possible to present the health situation in South Africa, especially in as far as HIV/AIDS is concerned. I just start by showing the situation only 21 years ago. The most reliable statistics we get in South Africa about HIV and AIDS is from pregnant women in our antenatal clinics. It's the most reliable because in our antenatal clinics, women have to test for HIV/AIDS, but also because it happened over a 21-year period, even before our first democratic elections in 1994. We're already doing this statistic. So it just shows that by 1990, the prevalence among pregnant women in South Africa was at 0.7%. But it just started steadily growing until we are now at 29.3%, meaning one out of every pregnant woman presenting at our antenatal clinics is HIV positive. And it shows province by province. We have got four provinces in South Africa. That's what we'll call states here. And the biggest of them all is KwaZulu-Natal, the KZN province, and it's our number one province, and it's in that order. It also shows that the highest prevalence is among pregnant women during childbearing age. That's where you find the peak of HIV, which is specifically problematic. Because we did that study over a 21-year period, I just took 4 years over these 21 years to show what has been happening in provinces in terms of prevalence. This is the province of the Eastern Cape. This is the province of Free State, which is regarded as the third highest in HIV/AIDS. That is the province of Limpopo, which is my home ground where I met Dr. Michael Sinclair for the first time. The district I come from is there at the bottom right, Sekhukhuneland district. That's where we started working with Michael Sinclair. The province of Limpopo is very rural, but in terms of HIV, it is not one of the worst. Together with Eastern Cape, which is also rural, and I'll explain later because it actually showed us something in terms of the battle that we need to be considering. This is Gauteng, the commercial capital of South Africa, the Gauteng province. As you can see there, the problems are mostly around the city of Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni. That's where the international airport is. This is the province of KZN. That's number one with your HIV AIDS. As you can see, the red area shows that in some districts, by the way, these maps are district by districts. In some districts, the prevalence is as high as 46%, as you can see. One of the districts there in 2006. So it's by far our biggest public health crisis all over South Africa is in this. And fortunately, because of these maps, as you know, the KwaZulu-Natal is one of the most rural province where the king is still very highly respected. And after being shown this map, the king himself has taken special interest and is leading the battle against HIV AIDS more than many traditional leaders can ever do. To an extent where he has even learned medical terms like where to find lymph nodes and all that, and symptoms and signs. It was because of the gravity this situation had when you were shown these maps that this is what's happening in your area. And this is the province of Mpumalanga, which is number two in terms of prevalence in our country. And this is the province of Northern Cape and the province of Northwest and the province of Western Cape. As you can see, Northern Cape and Western Cape have got a very slow prevalence. This maps here correspond with the history of South Africa. The province of KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and Eastern Cape are provinces which carried the brand of apartheid because the 10 homeland Bantustan governments were situated in this province. In my home province, there were three. In Eastern Cape, there were two, which were all independent. In KZN, it was the biggest. The province of Western Cape and Northern Cape had never had the homeland inside them, and it still shows in patterns of development up to today. And HIV/AIDS is following a similar pattern. So we just emphasizing that by 2006 already, according to Stats South Africa mortality figures, 6 out of 10 South Africans who were dying were below the age of 50. It's a very significant thing because it shows that age, because of HIV, we're having younger people dying and leaving the elderly behind. And we're trying to demonstrate when did this happen in South Africa. We are not always a country like that. But this happened swiftly over a period of 9 years, or let me say 8 to 9 years. As you can see there, these graphs are showing the pattern of death in terms of age. From 1997. The lowest graph there, I think is red if I'm not mistaken, shows that the peak of death was around 69 years, 79 years, I mean 70, 79 years. But over the years, it started shifting until by 2005, the top graph there shows that the peak of death is now occurring in a country around 30 years, meaning it's very young people who are dying. And that took place swiftly over a period of 8 years only. And we are comparing ourselves with Brazil, which is much in a better situation as far as HIV/AIDS is concerned, to show that the pattern of death among females between the ages of 15 to 64 in Brazil in 2004, that is the blue graph. In South Africa in 1997, that is the stepped-up graph. It shows that we're not very much different from Brazil, even though we're trying to wobble. By 2004 already, everything has changed. We had the peak of death, both at 30 years and 65 years, and these are young females. This state of affairs was revealed, but unfortunately not followed up by a president of the Medical Research Council in South Africa in 2001, who wrote in the journal. He was not talking about HIV specifically. He just said something is killing young women during childbearing age in South Africa, which is not in keeping with laws of biology. At least I still remember that quotation from the Medical Research Council. But I think he wasn't taken seriously at that time because people maybe didn't understand what he was trying to say. But this slide actually describes the situation that he was describing. The results of this is quite devastating. That you visit families, as I did with the vice president of the country, Deputy President Kgalema Motlanthe, who is the chairperson of South African National AIDS Council. In one of those red areas, red districts, we visited 4 families. And in all of them, you find the grandmother with 10 children between the ages of 3 and 50. And she'll tell you that these children belong to my daughters. They are all gone. And I'm remaining with them. Meaning grannies must now become mothers. That slide shows that early on in life, between the ages of 2 and 4, there are more males who are HIV positive than females. But when sexual activity starts at 15 years, when teenagers start being 15 years of age, the girls shoot up, as you can see from that slide, tremendously. And many studies have shown that it's females in South Africa who are carrying the brand of HIV/AIDS. At those ages, you find that among the boys, the prevalence is as low as 4%, 1%. But among the girls, it goes as high as 28, 80%. And so the brand is carried by females, as you can see. Later on in life, the situation changes. You have got more males now who are so early, and later on is males, but during sexual activities, more females. So I like saying HIV AIDS in my country, I don't know elsewhere, it's a disease brought on by males but suffered by females, unfortunately. Because the slide also shows intergenerational sex. That is quite older people who are having sex with these young girls and infecting them. That's why there is that difference. This sort of slide, I like showing it to end the debate in South Africa, because Mike, from 2009, as I said, we started a huge battle against HIV, is changing our approach, which was generally problematic. Quite a number of people accused me of over-exaggerating HIV/AIDS, that we have got other diseases in South Africa, like non-communicable diseases. And some people feel the minister never talks about them. Every time he talks about HIV/AIDS, and TB. That brings an end to the debate. This study was commissioned by the Lancet, the British Medical Journal, the Lancet. But the researchers were our own professors and researchers in South Africa. It simply shows that we have got a quadruple burden of disease. And in the order in which it occurs, HIV/AIDS and TB is number one. South Africa forms only 0.7% of the world population, but we are carrying 17% of HIV-positive people of the world, unfortunately. Our HIV/AIDS is 23 times the global average. So by far, TB and HIV/AIDS is the biggest public health disaster that the country has ever faced. So our second burden is maternal, newborn, and child health. In fact, mortalities. Maternal mortality, newborn mortality, and child mortality have shot up in South Africa because HIV/AIDS has been shown to increase maternal mortality, to have increased maternal mortality in South Africa 10 times. In other words, in terms of the, according to the National Confidential Committee on Maternal Mortality, 43% of maternal deaths in South Africa are caused by HIV, as are 35% of child mortality. So it is a big problem. And the third one, of course, is non-communicable diseases, which are on the rise. Like in any parts of the world, high blood pressure, diabetes, cardiac disease, etc. But in South Africa, there is a very clear pattern of relationship between non-communicable diseases and HIV and AIDS. For instance, cervical cancer is on the rise. In fact, in one of the biggest clinics in the country, that treats 10% of all the HIV people on treatment. When they did a pap smear among positive women, they found that the rate of positive pap smear is at 50%. So you are actually having a rise in cancer of the cervix of the uterus because of HIV. As are other cancers like Kaposi sarcoma and many other cancers, which some of us just read in textbooks, are coming back on the back of HIV/AIDS. The last one, I'm sure I don't have to lecture you, everybody believe that's what characterized South Africa, the issue of violence and injury. When people were being discouraged from coming to the World Cup, they were quoting that as the biggest problem. To us, it's only, according to our research, the fourth biggest problem that the country is faced with. Meaning when we plan the health system, we plan it around HIV/AIDS and TB, maternal and child mortality, non-communicable diseases, and lastly, on the issues of violence and injury. TB. I'm a member of the Stop TB Partnerships. That's why actually I'm here in Washington this week to attend a meeting of the Stop TB Partnership. They are the ones who produce this table. It's a 34-member international board, Stop TB Partnership, established by Global Fund. Immediately, as Global Fund was established, they established the Stop TB Partnership, and they released these statistics. That these are the 22 high-burden countries which are carrying 80% of the TB of the world. As you can see there, India, is number one, followed by China, Indonesia, Nigeria. South Africa is only number five. But that is because of the huge populations of those countries above us. If you do infection per population, we suddenly become number one. Our distance number two there is Zimbabwe. The last column is very problematic for us. It shows core infection, or what you call core morbidity. How many people are sharing both TB and HIV/AIDS? As you can see, in the very highly populated countries of India, China, Indonesia, even Nigeria, it's 5.3%, 1.9%, 3%, and 27%. In South Africa, it's 73%. For this reason, the co-infection of 73% has prompted us to regard TB and HIV as two sides of the same coin, same disease presenting in different ways, so that when you see somebody with HIV, think immediately TB. When you see somebody with TB, think HIV. And we have taken a policy decision that we need to treat them as such, under one roof, and take them as, you know, the same thing. The daily adjusted life years, what keeps people away from work? As we are trying to demonstrate that by far our problem is still HIV and AIDS and TB, not injury and violence, as people believe, because they contribute very little percentages, as you can see there. People are staying away from work mostly in our country because of a combination of HIV, AIDS, and TB, not because they are injured or not because there's violence. Those are contributing very little. And this just shows what I've just said, that when women are pregnant, among the HIV-negative ones, the mortality rate will be 34 per 100,000. But among the HIV-positive ones, it jumps to 328 per 100,000. Among those who died untested, it's 275. Both three figures showed the extent to which HIV, because those who died untested is very obvious from that figure that they have been HIV-positive, only that we never knew their status. Well, our problems with Millennium Development Goals is that in terms of mortality, maternal mortality, and in terms of infant mortality, even though we have put up teams of very highly qualified people because we think the figure of maternal mortality is high, but not as high as it was put there. We think it's somewhere between 300 and 400, but because of the complexities of, you know, rural statistics and all that, and the fact that many women don't present in hospitals, etc., mistakes will have been made in terms of figures, but they are being looked into. But as for now, these are the figures we are using. Actually, the main thing I want to demonstrate is that the maternal mortality has got worse after 1998, and it corresponds with the period at which HIV/AIDS reached the peak or started biting in the country. That's mostly what we wanted to show. And it also shows that here, that when babies are born HIV positive, they are 15 times more likely to die within the first 6 months. Put differently, HIV/AIDS increases the chance of dying the first 6 months by 1,500%. Now, in South Africa, because we have got 70,000 babies born annually HIV positive, that to us is very devastating. In the continent of Africa, the figure is 400,000. There are 400,000 babies born HIV positive in sub-Saharan Africa annually, and 70,000 is in South Africa. I was just comparing two provinces there in terms of mortalities and taking action. This is one, the province that is number two in HIV/AIDS, the province of Mpumalanga. It shows that in 1998, before HIV becomes worse, the lower graph, dark purple, shows that death was quite very low in the age group 0 to 11 months. In the first 11 months of life, death was not that low. But that figure changed swiftly, such that by 2006, you can see the peak there, and it's at 3 months. And this is the province of Western Cape. It was much worse than Mpumalanga there. Dark purple graph at the bottom. They reached a peak in 2003, at which time they started massive dual therapy. And the death dropped to the lower graph, I think it's the red one, at 2006. Just showing that if action is taken, results are actually seen and they are swift. I'm just trying to show that death doubled in South Africa. In the period between 1997 and 2006, corresponding again with the graph which shows the shifting of death patterns. If you go to our Home Affairs Department and check the death register, in 1997 it was indicating 317,000. I'm not talking HIV, overall death rate in the country. And by 2006, it has swiftly changed to 612, meaning there's a doubling of the death rate within that period of 9 months. And there won't be any other reason to give except HIV and AIDS. This is another very problematic statistics. South Africa passed the Termination of Pregnancy Act in 1997 because we were worried about lots of backstreet abortions. But unfortunately, it had the effects of producing so many young people doing legal abortions. And we think this is the problem that happened in sub-Saharan Africa, which even the United Nations population development picked up. That sub-Saharan Africa, when we started the battle against HIV/AIDS, because we believed prevention is very important, using condoms, we unfortunately dropped contraceptive programs, family planning. It no longer exists in many countries because they say if you introduce family planning, you will encourage young people not to use condoms. Unfortunately, the effect is this, simply meaning that regardless of that consent, we have got to bring family planning back, whether it's condoms or what. There has to be that because you can't have such young people. In other words, our conclusion from this is that many young people in sub-Saharan Africa, and in South Africa specifically, are using abortion as a contraception, as family planning, which is not good at all. This slide shows, it shows the issue I've just spoken about, the rate at which couples, specifically women, are protected against pregnancy using many modern contraceptive methods, including sterilization. As you can see, we're not doing very well. Our target is at the red line there. And so we need to pick up contraceptive programs more than ever before. We believe it was a mistake, the fear that sub-Saharan Africa have, that when you remove contraceptives, you push young people to use condoms. It clearly is not working. So contraceptives must also be used hand in glove with condoms. And this is primary health care utilization. Our target is up there. We are trying to indicate that our country has done something that I'm not sure how many countries in the world are battling with, running a curative healthcare system that is very expensive, where primary healthcare is no longer utilized. 41% of rural clinics in South Africa were built after Nelson Mandela became president. But the utilization has gone down, and people are preferring to use hospitals, most probably because primary healthcare, and Mike will get a little bit surprised because one of his biggest involvement with us was on primary health care, but it was soon dropped because people believe wrongly that when you get more sophisticated, you depend on a curative health care system because we have got money, technology, etc. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because diseases must be prevented, not treated. It doesn't work at all. So we are showing this because, and we're also showing that primary health care supervision rate is very low. We are doing so because I'm involved with a very, very difficult task of re-engineering the healthcare system in order for the healthcare system to be based on primary healthcare, on prevention and promotion of health rather than treatment, whether it's HIV, AIDS, TB, or any other diseases. Thank you.
Minister, thank you. It's refreshing to have a frank, fact-based presentation, and as startling and as horrifying as the facts are, it at least gives us that empirical basis for a good discussion. And I would like to ask Ambassador Goosby to make the remarks, please.
Well, I want to thank the minister, colleague, and friend, for his presentation, for the candor in it. I also want to acknowledge the difficulty it is in reflecting such numbers in also expressing the impact that this has on medical delivery systems and the health professionals within them and the patient communities that use them. It is extraordinary what South Africa has done under the minister's leadership. President Zuma has pivoted the country into engaging in an honest and candid way about the burden of disease that they are confronted with and their attention and focus in responding to it. Not a small lift, a huge lift. The most people on antiretrovirals on the planet is in South Africa, and the response to it is, I think, one of the most breathtaking things to see energized, and for that effort to crescendo now into more specifics around the programmatic impact and the convergence with the primary care agenda that the minister has put forward is truly the way forward. And the United States is proud to participate in this effort. I also want to highlight the fact that South Africa is moving their program, and always have been the primary funder of their program for the treatment component, and are moving aggressively to expand capacity at the provincial level and district levels for management, oversight, and monitoring and evaluation, corrective, reprogramming, retooling, refocusing of the effort to look at where the epidemic is indeed expanding, where the new seroconversions are, and to align prevention programs to link and respond to that moving edge of HIV into the population. This kind of geo-mapping and the alignment of programmatic emphasis on that moving, expanding edge is something that is very hard to move medical delivery systems to embrace it, but South Africa, again, is taking the lead on that. Moving toward a sustainable and, I think, progressively self-correcting system of care. The final area that I think is commendable and strong in South Africa is their embracing of civil society. The acknowledgement that an emergency response, as it moves into a sustained effort, needs to integrate and embed its programmatic footprint in the medical delivery systems that are in and of the public system, as well as embracing the role, the critical role that civil society and faith-based delivery systems play in completing that delivery. South Africa, from really early on, has used faith-based organizations in rural settings to cover that treatment need, and has created through the SANAC Council, the South African National AIDS Council, an entity that allows civil society to be at the planning table and at the table for the definition of the problem, but most importantly, to define the response. And the minister has been a leader in featuring the importance of that community dialogue and input, and instead of being hesitant towards it, has embraced it. And we are seeing now the benefit from that by looking at the programs getting stronger and being more responsive without it being a contentious dialogue. I think finally that the ability for the South African government to play the orchestrating role as the key planner in what and where the response should be tailored has been exemplary. South Africa, the government, becomes the orchestrator of divergent funding lines from Global Fund, from PEPFAR, from their own country's resources, as well as other foundations and other bilateral programs, to define one planning process that defines the unmet need. They prioritize that unmet need and then inform the allocation decisions that will best respond to these two epidemics. tuberculosis being the second epidemic that is converged in South Africa. They synergize with one another and again challenge the medical delivery system to be responsive. The minister spoke directly to that in some of his slides, looking at that overlap, but also looking at it as an opportunity to diagnose and treat both. South Africa really is the epicenter of the epidemic, and it is really breathtaking to see the government engage and crescendo in their response and orchestration of a meaningful and effective response. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. As you suggested, Minister, the burden of HIV on particularly the primary healthcare system, I think to a very large degree, and particularly in provinces like KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape, overwhelmed the system and has created a lot of the push from primary healthcare towards a more tertiary option, even poor people choosing to often case bypass their clinic and go to a doctor and pay out of pocket. And so as you're wrestling with this enormous issue of how to manage the HIV epidemic long term, you're also wrestling with the need to strengthen the health system overall. And so I think I would certainly encourage you in your responses later on to give us more information on that issue. And perhaps, Jennifer, you would like to make some comments in that regard.
Sure. Just a couple of points. First of all, we're delighted, CSIS, to co-host this with the Kaiser Family Foundation. It's a real honor to meet you. I think you and the Zoom administration have really breathed this new energy and enthusiasm and sense of optimism into discussions we've had with public health workers in South Africa. And I think into the partnership as well with the United States. Two things I wanted to touch on. First is the question of the big ambitious targets that you've set for yourselves. And those are laudable. I think it's important to set the bar high, but there's a lot of challenges that go along with that. I was a member of an Institute of Medicine committee on the long-term impact of HIV/AIDS and how best to prepare for that. I see Patrick Kelly from the IOM here. And I think, and I don't speak for the Institute of Medicine, but I think South Africa is really one of the cases we had in our mind about, I think, as we thought long-term into the epidemic. And the choices that we make today, how they affect what happens 10, 15 years down the line, and what capacities you need today, and what trade-offs eventually will need to be made. And it is a finite world. No matter how many efficiencies or more resources you generate, there's still going to be trade-offs. And South Africa, to me, was a prime example of that. One, in the new healthcare restructuring, the effort really to push out to primary healthcare facilities integrated and comprehensive HIV, TB, and other healthcare to improve access. That requires big investments in infrastructure, in human resources, in data collection, and so forth. And I think the human resource component is one of the most daunting challenges, to my mind, for South Africa. I was last there in August with my colleague Suzanne Brundage in the midst of the public sector strikes. Health workers were not immune. Some joined in the strikes, but I think some valiantly tried to get to work and couldn't make it. Now, the government is in a tough spot on that. It already has a major public sector wage burden, not just in health, but overall. But offers to increase wages by 7% were initially rebuffed. And I don't think it was because health workers or public sector workers were greedy or overly ambitious. I think many in the government acknowledge they're struggling to get by on very little, and they play this vital role. So that's a tough question that South Africa, I think, will have to answer, especially now as it has this big wage burden already, and with this push out to primary facilities, it's going to have to, that burden or that workforce is going to expand even further. How do you sustain that over time? The second big trade-off, and I know this gets a lot of discussion, is really on the burden of HIV treatment and the cumulative costs of that going forward over 10, 15 years as you look at those graphs. And, and the unfortunate but very real trade-offs and decisions that are going to have to be made. I think there's going to be public pressures to adhere to the WHO protocols, for example, or we heard more and more of kind of test-and-treat model, second-line therapies and so forth. Those costs, kind of what gives in that? Who makes the decisions on these important trade-offs? How does that get decided? Who gets impacted? And you know, that's something that we have in our own country with our health care reform and right now with budget cuts in Congress. Where do you cut to make a vision possible? Mm. So I'll stop there and come back perhaps later on the US, broader U.S. South African relationship.
Maybe, Minister, you would like to give some response before we take questions from the floor.
Yes. Well, obviously, I presented the problem. I didn't present the strategies yet. Yeah. Let me start with HIV, with HIV/AIDS. You are aware that on World AIDS Day 2009, the 1st of December 2009, The president of the country, President Jacob Zuma, announced, you know, made far-reaching announcement which turned the situation around on HIV/AIDS in South Africa. The four treatment regimens targeting what I've been showing you here. Firstly, pregnant women, that we need to treat them when the CDV count is 350 or less, and the co-infected people also. And the fact that all the children born HIV positive, I've already given you a figure of 70,000, we need to put them on treatment immediately. And lastly, to start prevention of mother to child transmission at 14 weeks rather than 28 weeks. That was broadly done, and it was welcome. But you also announced prevention strategies, starting with a massive HCT campaign where every citizen is encouraged to know their status, to test 15 million people. We have already to test and cancel 15 million people. Our target was by June this year. We are already at 9 million cancelled, about 7.7 who have been tested, and about close to 1 million of them tested positive. But we are moving in terms of knowing your status. Now, TB. Last week it was World TB Day on the 24th of May. We made three announcements also on how to combat TB. The first one, we are beneficiaries of the gene expert technology, which is just new, whereby we are able to diagnose TB within 2 hours rather than waiting for 4 weeks as we were doing before. We found it a very, very revolutionary development in the fight against TB. But the most important announcement we made on that day, a house visit, that if you have got such high-powered technology waiting in your health centers, we are waiting for those people who will come. What about those who don't even know that they should be coming? So we have decided to take the battle right into households. And from the 1st of February, we have put up teams to visit families. On our database, we have got 407,000 people with TB. We think all those families must be visited and screened for TB. So from the 1st of February, we have already covered 18,000 families just in that period. These are teams of five where you put a professional nurse, a lay counselor, and three primary health care workers to visit families. So that's to us, we believe, is the most important. And the third one, of course, is through Global Fund. We're giving money to put MDR hospitals, and we unveiled them last week, one per province. And I was saying it's a sort of a contradiction when you unveil and celebrate that, look, I've done something that will help people. Having MDR hospitals and utilizing them will increase if the house campaigns fail. If the house campaigns become successful, where you detect TB very early and treat it, then you won't need MDR hospitals. And so we're likely to close them as the house campaigns intensified. Now, lastly, the re-engineering of primary health care must be in terms of what I've just mentioned. And we have managed... we have identified three streams of primary health care in the country, which we are busy planning to launch either this year or early next year. The three streams are, we need five teams of very highly qualified people in each district in the country. principal gynecologist, principal pediatrician, principal midwife, principal primary health care nurse, and principal family physician. If you put them in this group of five in each district to fight the mortalities, then they'll also help in prevention. The second is ward-based primary health care agent, which we are the method we are using, we've seen it working very well in Brazil in their primary health care approach, in which we were taken there by Kaiser Foundation last year, and we have adopted it. And lastly, is a school health program where we think it's better to remove at least one nurse from each hospital and put them in schools. We better have a shortage of nurses in hospital and have an overabundance of them in schools. There are 12 million school kids in South Africa. We can't be waiting for them to get HIV, AIDS, and TB, as is likely to happen. Put a nurse there, and to stop what you saw there about contraceptive, you know, reproductive health rights, immunization, HCT campaign, TB screening, you know, all that must happen at school level. So that to the hospital, only those who go is after you have failed. That will tremendously reduce costs. If we come to Congress here and to Ambassador Guspe and keep on asking for money to put more people on ARVs, it's obviously a losing battle. It is a losing battle. So that's why primary health care to us is the key strategy, because you detect the problems before they even happen. This is what has been lacking in our country, as Mike is saying. People believe going to hospital shows development. You are more developed, you have got money, you have got transport, you have got medical aid, you have got lots of doctors, but that system doesn't work. Nor do I believe it will work in any part of the country. At the moment, we are engaged, like USA, in healthcare reforms in terms of healthcare insurance. And people are telling us it's completely unachievable. In the beginning, I didn't agree. I didn't understand them. Now I understand them. They are right. It's totally unachievable under the present method, where we wait for everybody to get sick and use the best possible technology to treat them. That is unachievable, I agree. Even if you were to give me $1 trillion, I think it will still be unachievable. But in a situation where you understand that diseases can be prevented and you can promote health, then anything is achievable. And that's precisely the package we are putting forward to the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. All right, the floor is now open. When you ask questions, please raise your hand, stand, and if you would give your name and your organization, a microphone will find you. So if I can have an indication of questions, and I think we'll take three or four together and then ask the panel to respond. So are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for being with us. My name is Chris Collins.
Stand, please.
Thank you so much, Minister, for being with us. My name is Chris Collins. I'm with AMFAR. I just want to underscore what others have said about your accomplishment on treatment delivery. Is amazing. It's inspiring. We want to learn from it. We want to celebrate it, so thank you. And in that vein, you know, you talked about the connection between HIV and maternal mortality, the need to make reforms and increase demand around primary care. You know, in this country, we're engaged in the Global Health Initiative and kind of redefining some of what we do in global health. I'm wondering what the lessons are from your experience in terms of using the HIV response as a foundation to build out to other health services. What are the lessons that might be useful for the Global Health Initiative here in terms of how the AIDS response is a foundation for broader health delivery?
Okay, other questions? Way in the back.
Hey, my name is Benjamin with the Center for Interfaith Action on Global Poverty. I was just wondering if you could comment on what you see as the potential promise in pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV, which is currently under 9 different medical concurrent trials, and we've also seen the initial results, which show some promise. But both for the minister and for Ambassador Guspe, how you see it potentially playing a role in HIV prevention down the road?
Okay, and there was somebody else to the right.
Yes. Saul Levin of the American Medical Association and former president of Medical Education for South African Blacks. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you're going to create the pipeline of training the healthcare professionals that are going to have to take care of the population that is now affected and where you see some of the economics of that playing out.
All right, why don't we...
Can I just get that here?
Training healthcare professionals. And how is the cost of that going to play out? And that feeds into the issue that was being raised by Jennifer earlier about expanding the workforce, the healthcare workforce, et cetera, et cetera. Perhaps, Ambassador Goosby, you would like to start with the prophylaxis question because that's probably a fairly concise answer, and then Minister, if you would answer.
Sure. That's not me, huh? The use of pre-exposure prof is exciting to think and decide how that could indeed be integrated into a prevention effort that includes populations that are participating in highest risk. Sex workers, men who have sex with men, injection drug users, individuals who are in a migratory pattern, truck drivers, miners who are in a transient mode for many months out of the year. All of these populations need to be targeted and looked at as individuals and as groups that could indeed benefit from a strategy that included a pre-exposure prof. Matched with other prevention interventions that also target these same populations to keep them negative over time is something that the PEPFAR program is looking at in a number of different settings, including KwaZulu-Natal at this point. So something we're looking at, trying to understand how it best could impact and synergize with other prevention efforts.
Yeah. Well, Our prevention strategies as such, I only mentioned one, the HCT, Know Your Status. But we are actually using 9 prevention strategies. One of them is this post-exposure prophylaxis. We have not yet rolled it over, but we have in the way Ambassador is describing. But we have adopted it as one of the strategies, prevention strategies. The other one, which I forgot to mention, which is speaking to some of what you saw on the maps there, is medical male circumcision. We found that, curiously, the areas that are red there are coinciding with areas in South Africa where there's no traditional circumcision. In South Africa, you have got a lot of tribal groups, and some of them do circumcision, others don't. And we found that those who are not practicing circumcision, the areas are red, like the Zulu Nation. That's why the king has taken so much interest. Because they stopped the practice of circumcision 200 years ago when Shaka became king during the wars. And the king has just canceled that 200-year tradition that they must now circumcise, but they do so medically, no longer traditionally. So it's one of the methods. So I'm just saying it's post-exposure prophylaxis, medical male circumcision, Know Your Status, provision of condoms, a safe blood transfusion, which, by the way, I don't know why we forgot to mention with Ambassador here. We have achieved through the help from PEPFAR. I can safely say it, getting HIV infection from blood transfusion in South Africa is close to zero because of the help we got from PEPFAR in putting state-of-the-art facilities. So we do have some things to celebrate, actually. Now, the issue of training, yes, it is quite grave. Seeing that in South Africa, the training we are doing is not only for us. We are training for the neighboring countries. Many countries within SADC don't have medical schools. The medical schools are in South Africa. Namibia doesn't have, Lesotho doesn't have, Swaziland doesn't have, you know, and many others, right up to Rwanda and all that. All those people are being trained in South Africa. And yet, unfortunately, we've been producing 1,200 doctors per annum for the past 10 years, regardless of that and the burden of disease. We have just started to expand that. We are dreaming about increasing that 3 times. We don't know whether that's going to be possible, but we are putting up that plan. The second area is about nurses. When you have got such a big burden of disease, you can't rely on doctors. You have to have very highly qualified nurses and trained in large numbers. In fact, by February last year, we only have 250 nurses who were licensed to initiate ARVs, and we're only having 490 centers which could initiate ARVs. We have increased the centers to 2,000 because the number of nurses who have been trained has actually increased tremendously, 10 times. And because if you were to expand that and use doctors only, you won't be able to achieve it. So for this reason, we are calling a huge big nursing conference next week. Those who know understand the history of South Africa, we brought the new South Africa through a process called CODESA. We call that nursing conference a CODESA of nursing. That we need to have to start the whole nursing profession afresh in terms of the number of people trained, the level of training, where do they get the training, etc., in order to be able to fight this burden of diseases. That will supplement the work doctors doing. But lastly, South Africa has adopted what you call mid-level workers. People who, it's a new profession of mid-level workers. We only produce 23 by now because it's only one university. People who are not doctors, but they are not necessary that they go for a four-year training at the university. They can do some of the work which is done by doctors or assists, but also can do some of the work which nurses are not able to do. And we thought this is a new level of worker that will help in terms of HR. You, Jennifer, you've mentioned something about the strike. We have consulted many nurses even before this summit as a build-up. Nurses don't want to go on strike. The problem is that in South Africa, we've got the trade unions all over and they're affiliated as in federations, youth federations, which will say, if anybody goes on strike, all of us must go, we all workers and all that. But nurses are trying to discourage that because they understand their role as essential workers. And many of them definitely, I'm dead sure, don't like it. But the reason that we are having this situation in South Africa is the wage gap between, you know, we are a very unequal society. The wage gap between the rich and the poor is too big in South Africa. If we don't close that, this issue of having strikes will always happen. Because workers believe, look, there is money elsewhere, but it's being received by a few people who are super rich and who are being left behind. So they just feel like striking all the time. If there can be closure of this gap, doesn't exist in many countries, I must tell you. Brazil used to be higher than us, and I'm not sure, but I understood they are closing it. In South Africa, this gap is huge, but obviously, coming from the era of apartheid, you can understand how it came about. And the after effects is that you're having strikes all the time where people feel, there is money, all I have to do is to strike, then I'll get it. Then you have to convince them that it's actually not like that. Thank you.
Minister, the other question related to the extent to which your rollout of antiretrovirals might have some lessons for addressing, tackling some of the other health priorities in terms of health systems development and so on.
Yes. Obviously, rolling out this HIV has taught us a lot of lessons in terms of training people. For instance, when you roll out, you need a lot of laboratory staff. Mm. You have to do training. You need a lot of task shifting. You have got to shift, as I said, you are shifting over to nurses. And you expand many more centers and you involve lay counselors, you involve primary health care people. It brings a lot of lessons to in terms of HR. But also, Mike, you see, my worry is I was not very happy on World AIDS Day when the president announced these measures because the media was more excited about treatment. Yeah, and that worries me. They were saying South Africa has turned the corner at long last this treatment. I wanted them to get more excited about prevention. And that's the battle I'm fighting, to turn everybody's attention towards prevention, not to believe that once treatment has arrived, the problem is over. Because it can be. I mean, imagine it's a newborn baby who goes on treatment today. If he's going to live for 60 years, it means for 60 years you'll be taking tablets, assuming that nothing will change. That's not good life. It's not a win. So the issue of rolling out but also encouraging prevention is the best lesson that we think everybody else must learn.
Okay, good. Questions?
You know, if I could just answer little bit. The two things. Our programs, PEPFAR programs, have seen the need to support the expansion of medical professions from the very beginning of PEPFAR. And we are happy to say that in the last month, we've been able to start an initiative with the National Institute of Health that looks at the medical education needs in 11 different countries and 16 different medical schools in sub-Saharan Africa. South Africa, as the minister alluded to, is playing a partner role with a number of institutions in other areas in sub-Saharan Africa. The unique aspect of this initiative is that it targets the medical school, the African medical school, to be the principal investigator, and then they choose who they want to have as a colleague in curriculum development, revamping the curriculum to make it more problem-oriented, more family practice kind of focused from an American perspective, and to work with the faculty to teach them how to teach in an excellent fashion. So it really is a initiative that's focusing on increasing the training capability of the medical schools. It adds a 2 to 3 year residency for medicine, pediatrics, OBGYN, and surgery at the end of the medical school training as the medical student moves into their first years of in-hospital time for a 3 year period. And then also teaches them the methodologic skills in clinical research, how to read clinical research, and make it part of their toolbox in understanding and caring for patients. So bringing that skill set into the medical school setting. We're also doing that in nursing schools. South Africa's medical schools, two of them, are some of the twinning or collegial relationships that other medical schools have identified to partner with. In terms of the GHI question that Chris asked, there are many lessons that we learned from our work outside of the United States that have informed and given us insights into strategies that may be more effective. The idea of using existing medical platforms on which we add other services to expand the service capability of that medical platform, be it HIV/AIDS, be it maternal and child health, that just makes sense. And we believe we'll be able to extend the service portfolio of programs that we're already engaged with significantly to enhance the services that the individuals who are using these service sites can benefit from.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to start with some questions. And starting in the back there. Way in the back, and then we'll work our way forward. Can we get a mic in the back there, please?
Thank you, Honorable Minister. I'm Benjamin Mutambi, also from South Africa. I want to commend you for turning this thing around in the way that you and the new leadership have done. And restoring our promise to our people towards primary health care. My question is with regards to the big goal that we have for knowing your status. Out of 50 million citizens, reaching 15 million is still a little far from where we should be. And certainly, it may not be realistic or necessarily desirable to reach all 50 million. So the question really might be one of prioritization. And in a country where the epidemic is so generalized, what do you see as the way forward in terms of who we should reach first with this program? Who are the people we should prioritize? Thank you.
All right, thank you. There's just a little bit further forward. Janet?
Thank you very much, all of you on the panel, and especially the minister. My name is Janet Fleischman. I've done a lot of work with CSIS on gender and issues of HIV and global health. And I wonder if you could speak for a minute about the integration of family planning and HIV. You spoke so eloquently about the situation of women and girls of reproductive age in South Africa, and clearly they have reproductive health needs and HIV issues that are often linked, and each can be a platform for helping to address the other. And I wonder if you could speak for a minute about your plans or your strategy to look at those, the integration not only of TB and HIV, but family planning and HIV. Thank you.
All right. I think there was a question just in front of you, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Nene Fofana with Population Services International, PSI. I want to thank you for this opportunity to be here and respond to questions. And my question is about public-private approach. You are talking about this very interesting public health program that you're trying to bring up to scale. And I wanted to know how your government is, or how you'll be working with the private sector to make that happen. Thank you.
All right. So, Minister, quite a menu there. Would you like to start, and then we'll ask Jennifer also to chime in.
Yes. Well, the issue of putting a target of 15 million South Africans by June obviously was not a goal in itself, which after reaching then it closed up. We just targeted it to have a period of heightened activity. So that, in other words, to bring awareness. Obviously, I would like people to test even thereafter. And I love to many of them to test more than once. In other words, we just initiated it for South Africans to start learning that you have to test for HIV every year. In some sectors, that has been achieved. For instance, Anglo Coal, which is one of the biggest mining companies. When I visited them 2 weeks ago, I found that every year their workers are testing. And because they've launched this successfully, they reach a 94% testing rate among their workers. It's an annual thing. So we were trying to establish that annual thing by saying we're targeting 15 million people. Obviously, if at the end it's all 50 million who have tested, I'll be very happy. Mm-hmm. And so the media was asking us that, no, this figure is not going to be correct. Some people are going to repeat. I said, yes, I'm encouraging them, actually. I'm testing at every available opportunity. When I show people that they need to test. In my own department, when I test the workers, I tested. At the launch, when the president tested, I did so. We want to take the campaign to parliament. I'm insisting that all members of parliament must test publicly. I'm going to test again. So every available opportunity, so that people must get used to this. So the figure of 15 was just to have a target, really. The figure of 15 million. And who are the people who are targeting specifically? We want to take the campaign into schools. We have already started adversities, and I will answer many questions at the same time when it comes to PPPs. For instance, the people who are doing the testing in our universities is the private sector, all pharmaceutical industry. They came together and said, Minister, we want to help you. Let's take the university students, and they launched this campaign in universities. So it's another public-private partnership that is going on. We need to test people in the farms. We need to do so in industry. And we have already started, for instance, with Eskom. Our Eskom is South African Electricity Commission, our power supply. Because I have been able to show them that one of the red areas there is where most of the power stations are. And they got scared, and we started the program to go to the power stations with them. It was initiated by the deputy president of the country personally, and so we are doing it with them. And Marian Roberts, one of our biggest construction companies, joined in. Wherever they've got the construction site with lots of workers, we go with them there, we test. And they fund some of these things, so showing again that it's another PPP. The integration of family planning and HIV is one of the most important deliverables that must come. So in our school health programs, that's basically what you are targeting, that if you have got the school health nurse, they are there exactly for that, for contraceptive health right, integrating HIV AIDS treatment and family planning. But this morning I met the International Partnership for Micropesticides, and Eric, you see, if they get successful, this will be a revolution. This micropesticide ring to protect against HIV, where they are also trying to impregnate it with, to put this ring with micropesticide and contraceptives, that will be a revolution. The problem in sub-Saharan Africa of dumping contraceptives because they are scared that if you don't use condoms only, young people might believe that I'm not going to fall pregnant because I'm on contraceptives, but not use condoms and end up being exposed to HIV. If you've got a micropesticide ring, which has got both contraception and ARVs in the gel, that's a revolution we want to see. It will integrate the facilities very well. But we are busy integrating them in this school health program. Our main motivation of having school health programs is to do exactly that, apart from the other things. Now, the private public-private partnership I've already mentioned. Last week, I met CEOs of no less than 15 companies who came and said, Minister, we want to participate in these health problems. Where do we start? And I give them two, that I'm giving you HIV/AIDS and the HR. The HR we're speaking about here. How many people can you sponsor to become doctors, nurses, pharmacists, physiotherapists? I said, go back and work that and come back and meet me. Only on these two, then we'll start talking. So that's going to be a huge PPP, public-private partnership. Because I said we might not be sharing lots of things in common, but what you are sharing are the human resources. When you train doctors, some of them go to work for private companies. So if there are more, there will be enough for both the state and them. And I said they must try and fund such programs.
Jennifer, would you like to comment on this human resource public-private issue?
One question I did want to ask was the intersection between the private health sector and the public health sector. You know, there are some models of kind of co-location within health facilities of private and public. That was one. I guess I'd kind of rather step back because it strikes me through the conversations, whether on training and the new kinds of models that you were mentioning, I think that follow very much along kind of the Fogarty research partnerships with South Africa. I mean, for all the challenges that South Africa has, it has some amazing and very unique capacities and really in playing kind of a catalytic role in the region and in Africa more broadly. You know, the lessons that you took from Brazil, I think probably a lot of African countries can turn to South Africa on the TB-HIV intersection, not just in your programming, but also in the basic research that's being done in South Africa, in KRITH, in CAPRISA, and so forth. In the integration and the primary health care push of family planning, TB and HIV, in terms of kind of the new model of a U.S. engagement with South Africa, I think that's focusing less on the provision of ARTs and more on these kinds of catalytic issues of training, human resource development, and so forth. I really kind of see South Africa in that way on so many of these things, on circumcision, so many of the things that you mentioned on these kinds of new prevention technologies, on measures of incidence, so much that in a way that South Africa is grappling with the broader world can learn from. And I tend to think that U.S. engagement with South Africa will be moving in future. South Africa is, after all, a BRIC now, or BRICSA, or whatever you want to call it, towards that kind of catalytic kind of role. So in that, I wonder, in all of these things that you're trying out, your outreach in the rest of Africa and in the region, kind of how you see yourself playing that broader role on all of these things that you're trying out within South Africa. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So how much are you sharing with the rest of the continent?
Well, the first thing is that you must understand that South Africa is two countries in one. Mm-hmm. We have got the Western country and the developing country, third world country, in one country. Take, for instance, this issue of medical care. There are lots of high-tech medical procedures which can be done in the rest of the subcontinent. They are all done in South Africa because we have got a very strong, highly developed private healthcare sector. But that worries us, that hand in glove with that, you've got the huge burden of HIV/AIDS, high maternal mortality, high infant mortality. It doesn't make sense to be so highly developed on one side but have such high mortalities. And that's why I want to produce primary health care as an intersection between the two. But our level of engagement with the continent is that we're doing that almost every week. I must approve somebody coming from the neighboring countries to do some form of procedure or the other. So that's the first level. The second level, I've told you, in training, we're training lots of people from within the subcontinent. But the third one, because South Africa is an economic giant in the region, there is a feeling. For instance, in the mines, the people working in the mines are mostly not South Africans. They come from Lesotho, Botswana, Swaziland. And so there's a lot of migration
and they got worried about this issue of TB. The reason that we have got that high burden apart from HIV/AIDS is from the mines. Remember that South Africa had got a migrant labor system where husbands were forced to leave their wives and come and work in the mines in single-sex hostels. So it also accounted for the problem that we're having. So what we are planning now through the Stop TB partnership is to call all the ministers of health in Southern Africa, all the ministers of minerals and labor, and ministers dealing with migration to come and draw a common strategy for the whole region, not only for South Africa. We will drive it, but it will be for the whole region, such that in South Africa, if we have got this plan for TB, it must all be for the whole region. If we have got this protocol for HIV, so whether a worker is in the mine in South Africa or in Lesotho, they must be on common treatment. And that's what we are doing to influence the region. And South Africa is, of course, driving that type of strategy because they see us as a problem, but also as a solution at the same time. Thank you.
All right. So let's go to questioning up front here now. Jack, can you get a mic? Oh, here we go.
My name is Samuel Adeni Jones from U.S. Department of Health. One of the cornerstones of the Global Health Initiative is moving towards country ownership. Conceptually, it looks like a great idea, but there are many challenges. I remember President Zuma, when he was president in waiting, visited the U.S. with Dr. Zweli Mkhize. And when they met with counterparts from the Ministry of Health and OGAC, one of the issues that President Zuma actually very eloquently put forward was that this concept was good, but it has to be well planned. Couldn't be precipitous. It has to have a transition. And he said actually a long transition. Mm-hmm. So from the point of view of South Africa, what have you learned about the transition, and what ideally do you see as a good transition towards country ownership for a program like HIV/AIDS?
All right, good. Are the questions right behind you there?
Hi, my name is Patty Webster. I'm with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and I'm honored to be here, and thank you all very much for sharing your insights. I know that one of the major points of your plan, Honorable Matsulede, was quality improvement methodologies, and I'd love to hear more plans to further spread this. I think there's been phenomenal examples across South Africa of how quality improvement has been used from the bottom up to really impact on our health systems, to improve the systems, given the resource constraints that we have, and that goes back to the question of the HR constraints. I'd love to hear further plans on spreading these methodologies to retain patients in care now as we have a system that we need to chronically manage these patients, because there's been some fantastic examples already in South Africa. And coupled with that, my question is what plans to involve the community and patients as one of the most underutilized resources that we have to help improve those systems and get their perspectives on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right behind you, yes.
Thank you. Amanda Little, Georgetown University, Minister, Ambassador, Doctors. I would like to return to the question of training and look at the flip side of it. As someone who's been involved with medical and nursing education for a long time, it's not just the training or the education, it's the retention of the worker after they have been well educated. As you're having a fresh look, particularly at nursing, even next week, will this be on the agenda so that South Africa doesn't just put a lot of resources into training many and the various types of healthcare workers, but they can also retain them and also look at how they can be good, maybe regional neighbors, so they're not attracted to the other countries surrounding South Africa that many workers often want to come after they've received training in their own countries? Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Minister, do you want to kick off on ownership issues?
I think we've already started in South Africa. While we need help, and PEPFAR is helping us a lot, Ambassador Goosby knows, but 80% of the HIV AIDS program in the country, we pay them on our own, and we keep on expanding so that
we think we must reach a situation where if we ask for help, it shouldn't be to buy drugs. We should be able to do that on our own. And a lot has happened between us and the Treasury and the President after the World AIDS Day announcement to move towards that. The second thing that we did with the help of the Clinton AIDS Initiative, the Global Fund, PEPFAR, etc., we had discovered that we were buying the most expensive ARVs of any country in the world, regardless of having the biggest rollout. Through that, we've been able to slash the prices by whooping 53%. We cut it down by 53%, meaning that we can treat two times the number of people with the same budget. That even makes ownership of the programs much easier. But we like to own them because we think it's sustainable. We believe when help comes, it doesn't mean you fold your arms and say, they take over. It means they push you. We don't want to become wheelbarrows. You know? The wheelbarrow, you pick it up and push it. When you leave it there, it waits for you there until you come. We want to be pushed a little bit of a distance, and we start on our own. And that's how we understand the issue of ownership. The issue of involving community. Our primary health care model is actually to do that. The primary health care model we're trying to, we're even dividing it at the ward level. There are about 4,000 municipality wards in South Africa. We want to put 10 primary health care agents in each ward. These people are nominated by the community and trained by us and working for us, but chosen by the community. In other words, you go to them and ask them. In every rural community specifically, when they've got problems, they know who they go to. That person might not be having any official status, but they know that if there's no water, if somebody's sick, if there's no transport, if a woman is pregnant and is giving birth and, you know, there's no transport, there's usually somebody who is unelected but always do that work. Such people are usually chosen as counselors. But if they don't make it as counselors, you can use them as primary health care agent. That will help you to involve the community. For instance, the fact that pregnant women must be treated at 14 weeks rather than 28 weeks for prevention of mother-child transmission will only work in as far as the women who are pregnant come in to test. If you don't know them and they are not even coming to test, or communities don't mobilize them, it won't help. So it will only work if communities don't know who is pregnant, whether they've tested, if they're positive, are they on PMTCT, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the involvement of communities is very key in that regard. The issue of retention, I'm sure you are aware that the World Health Assembly debates this issue on an annual basis. Even this year, it will be there in Geneva because almost every country is suffering this issue of migration of health workers. The WHO passed a resolution about retention on what we need to be doing. We are implementing that resolution, but we are also having bilaterals. For instance, we had a huge bilateral with the UK about them to try their best not to take nurses from us. Because and they've agreed. When I was in the UK in March, there were about 78 nurses left from South Africa. When just before that, there were about 1,700. So it's working when you negotiate. But also, we also are seen as, while we are complaining that the Western countries are taking doctors from us, we are poor. But many African countries are complaining that South Africa is taking their doctors and they are poor. So it depends who is richer than the other. And so we have got protocols. For instance, within SADC, we have got protocols that we must not actively recruit workers, health workers from around SADC countries. It doesn't usually work because some of them are there. For instance, I've got lots of Zimbabwean doctors in South Africa. I didn't recruit them. They came. So in that case, I said, look, this resolution can apply. I'm just going to employ them. But it causes problems within SADC. They say, no, everybody will soon be coming out. So at the nursing summit, we are going to discuss with the nurses the strategies for retention. What is that which the nurses believe government must do in order to retain them so that they don't go away? That definitely is going to be on the agenda. It's going to be under training. What type of training? For instance, with these mortalities, you may say, I want to train more midwife, more primary health care nurses, more pediatric nurses, etc., etc. And we want agreement at the nursing summit from the nurses themselves. But then they'll tell us, what should I do as a minister to retain them in their position so that they don't go away? But it's not something that we think will always work 100%, because there's a contradiction between two United Nations agencies here, the World Health Organization and the International Labour organization. The International Labor Organization says it's a right of every worker, health worker or not, to work anywhere they want in the globe, and it's their right. Then the World Health Organization says, look, don't recruit from developing countries. It's dangerous. So between those two, we're trying to survive because we subscribe to both of them. Thank you.
Ambassador Goosby, do you want to comment on the pace of ownership, the transition, and the extent to which that is a sort of a mapped out strategy as opposed to one that might be expedited through funding constraints?
Well, I think that South Africa really is taking a regional lead in presenting itself as the responsible orchestrating convener of resources as they come into their country. And I think are creating the institutions that can identify accurately, scientifically, that unmet need and a process in place to prioritize that unmet need to make the correct allocation decisions. We are very gratified at South Africa's embracing of this leadership position and are hopeful that they will be the model that we look at as the United States government in dealing with our partner countries in the transition from a more typical bilateral-dominated entry in that emergency response that PEPFAR represented as we move into a more sustained response that better ensures that the services are indeed there for as long as they're needed. We believe that the country ownership is the key to that pivot, enables and positions the country to successfully play that orchestrating role with all these divergent resources to address what is still a significant unmet need. We believe that the partnership frameworks that PEPFAR has used as a tool to have these discussions map out a 5-year commitment on part of the country and on part of the United States government. And with our colleagues in the Global Fund, and as we now move into a different dialogue and relationship with them, to really allow us to identify synergies, cooperations that save money, that are smarter, and allow us all to save more lives in this effort. I think South Africa really does typify stepping up to that plate, embracing it, and moving forward with it, not as a separate entity, but in a real partnership with USG resources that we are quite confident will be a model for that type of transition. Resources being what they are, budgets being what they are, they put the external pressure on us to move. But they don't tell us how to do it. And we still have the ability to be smart and strategic in how we allow these resources to move to program. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, I wonder in that vein, the minister is going up to the Hill in a little while, whether in the context of the evolving political environment and perspectives on global health funding and the U.S. government's commitment to global health funding going forward, whether you have some suggestions for some of the kinds of concerns and issues the minister might address?
Well, I do think that, you know, you want to highlight the track that you're on, which is moving away from kind of direct provision by the U.S. and U.S. intermediaries of services, of antiretrovirals and so forth, to the kind of, as I said before, kind of catalytic investments that the U.S. is making in South Africa. I think, South Africa is an emerging economy. It's very important to the United States, I should say. If you look at the Obama national security strategy, South Africa is mentioned frequently as a big new partner for the United States to engage with. You have Secretary Clinton and the State Department and the White House very keen on renewing and reinvigorating that relationship. It's always been a strong partner, but I think, you know, the last administrations, both here and in South Africa, didn't always see eye to eye. I think there's been a real shift in the relationship. I think your role and President Zuma's role on health has been a big factor in that, but there are other things as well. I think there's a lot of willingness from the White House and State Department to push for that improved relationship. As I said, the PEPFAR transition that's already happening is something to be on track, the kind of catalytic investments. And I think of ways of engaging at a broader than government-to-government level. That's the kind of model that you're talking about, med school to med school, researcher to researcher. You have tons of wide-eyed young public health graduates from the United States flocking to South Africa because they, you know, and there's a constituency here that's really interested in public health and in South Africa. And because I think South Africa can play that regional role and a model role on some of these really tough challenges, the trade-offs, the HIV-TB intersection, the family planning HIV intersection, I think, you know, that's a place that we're going to continue to invest in, even if the financial aspect of the relationship declines somewhat this year, maybe next year. I think those are kind of the things to emphasize.
Thank you, Jennifer and Ambassador. I think that both those comments are a very good note on which to conclude this session. I'm sure, Minister, you have sensed from both the attendance here and the remarks that South Africa remains of very high interest and importance. And I think that there is a great sense of wanting to be able to celebrate South Africa's accomplishments always. And so just as we celebrated the World Cup, and it wasn't only South Africans who celebrated, I know many, many Americans who don't care a hoot for soccer, really thought it was fantastic that South Africa had been able to pull it off in the fashion that they did. And I think here again today, you have demonstrated that tenacity, that perseverance and style that Americans love to celebrate about South Africa. So we thank you very much. We wish you good luck. You have a long way to go. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.